Evening, everybody.
Evening.
Tonight, we're going to continue our periodic series called Why Should I Believe? By continuing to talk about arguments for the existence of God. Last week, we started this lesson off looking at one of those arguments. Tonight, we'll do one, maybe two, depending on how wordy I am. But you guys know I'm really wordy. Stop smiling, everybody. But we'll go as far as we can tonight. But just a little recap on where we've been. So we started at the very beginning talking about, you know, kind of asking the question, why do we need to study this if we already believe? Well, one is that it is a scriptural mandate given by Peter to be able to explain why we believe what we believe. What's the reason for the hope that is within us? But also talked, in that lesson a little bit about how whenever we're having interactions with others, we have to be able to start where they are. And if they do not believe in the Bible, it's going to be hard for us to start with the Bible and having a conversation. And that can unfortunately even include our own children, our own grandchildren, other members of our family. If they believe, as there is presented in many textbooks, that evolution is a fact, it's not a theory, it's proven away the existence for God, the need for the existence of God, maybe we need to talk to our children about some of these types of things. And so there's a myriad of reasons why we need to be able to understand these things. From there, we spent a few weeks talking about holes in Darwin's theory of evolution, the holes of evolution not being able to explain how life comes from non-life. There, scientifically, that cannot be explained other than saying it is a very, 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 very remote chance of it happening randomly, which we would look at as a, you know, naturalistic impossibility. We looked at the whole of no evidence in the fossil record of kinds developing from other kinds. If Darwin's theory were true, it means that all living things came from a single cell organism. And so we would expect to find in the fossil record all those intermediate links where you go from one kind to another kind. And from what I study about science, those links simply do not, there's no evidence for those links. And Darwin himself said he expected for those things to be found. And so far, those links are missing. And then the third hole we looked at was the hole of what has been labeled irreducible complexity, that if evolution were true, it means that every system that exists in the natural world had to have developed by small changes over vast periods of time. But looking at that in reverse, if you can find a system that could not have developed by a series of small changes, meaning if you take away one element of that system, the whole system would fail. And what we have found is that there are many examples of those systems. Even within our own bodies, there are examples of those systems where if you remove even one part, the whole system will fail. The next lesson we looked at, the question about, you know, what about dinosaurs? Because dinosaurs are often, especially with our children, their introduction into the ideas of evolution. And we looked at maybe the possibility that dinosaurs could have existed alongside humans. Whatever the case, that there are explanations for dinosaurs that do not have to include Darwin's theory of evolution, do not have to include macroevolution. Then last week we started this lesson on arguments for the existence of God. As I said at the time, I have been in Christian evidences classes before, where it seemed like the idea was, well, if I can disprove Darwinism, that will prove the existence of God. But those two things are not necessarily tied to each other. Why do we start with Darwinism? Because Darwinism can pull away people, to make people think that it explains away the need for God. But even if we come to the conclusion that Darwin's theory cannot hold the weight of my faith, that doesn't necessarily say that, well, then I automatically believe in God. And so we have conversations about what are some of the arguments for why we can believe in God. Now, as I said at the time also last week, the existence of God cannot be proven in the sense of like proven in a court of law, you know, where you can provide physical evidence. You know, no one's going to be able to physically see God or touch God. So ultimately, a belief in God has to come down to faith. As the Hebrew writer said, you know, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith becomes our evidence. But there are logical things that we can look at that lead us to seek out who might be the designer of this incredible universe that we live in. So we began this conversation, and we started by talking about a passage from the Bible. This is really, I think, the first verse that I pulled up since the first lesson. And that is Paul in the Roman letter, where he, in beginning to talk to the Gentile world, points to the creation. Because the Gentile world did not have the law, right? They didn't have the law. And so some would say, well, they have an excuse for why they didn't follow God. And Paul says, for what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. You think about the things that have been made, that includes our surroundings, the natural beauty that is around us, but it also includes us, the incredible complexity of the human body. I remember I had a good friend who, when he was going, he's now a radiologist who works for the University of Kentucky. But I remember when he was going through medical school, he said he was having a conversation with one of his professors. And this was not a, quote, religious school. But they said they were having the conversation together of, like, how could somebody go through medical school studying about the intricacies of the human body and come away with the idea that this was all a bunch of random chance? So even Paul said the creation is screaming, there has to be a creator. He is encouraging everyone to look out at creation, even looking at ourselves. And that is what these kind of ideas about arguments of the existence of God are really kind of calling to. At least these first two that we're going to look at. We've looked at one. We're going to look at the second one tonight. The first one we looked at is what is labeled the cosmological argument. And as I said, the technical phrase is the Kalam cosmological argument, because there are other cosmological arguments. As there are many, many logical arguments for the existence of God, I'm choosing not to go down every single rabbit hole, because this entire series will just be on this. So I'm pulling out the ones that I personally find the most compelling. And just as a one-slide recap, the cosmological argument is this: whatever begins to exist has a cause. And as I talked about last week, we see evidence of things beginning to exist all the time. I pointed out five examples. You know, one, an automobile. An automobile, no one looks at an automobile and think that it just spontaneously appeared out of thin air, right? Or that it has always been there, right? You look at an automobile and you know that someone designed it, gathered the materials, and constructed it, right? Same thing is true of a home. You know, if you were to go out and look on the MLS listings for all the real estate in Pleasant View and pull up, you know, every single house that is for sale, every one of them will have a year constructed date. Why? Because it was created, right? It began to exist because it was created. It has a cause, okay? Again, someone designed it, gathered the materials, and constructed it. We said the same thing is true of us. And animals. You know, raise your hand if you were present at the signing of the Declaration of Independence. I wasn't, right? My parents were not alive back then. My grandparents were not alive back then, right? And if my parents had not been together, then I would not be here, right? We have a cause, right? And so if that is true, if that premise is true, which again, I believe is almost universally accepted among the things that we see begin to exist, then the second thing says the universe began to exist. And we talked about that, how prior to the 20th century, science believed that the universe was eternal. And it was only at the beginning of the 20th century, when Einstein was working on his theory of general relativity, that he could not make the equation work because the universe was not constant. And so he put in a little fudge factor to balance the equation. And later scientists who came after him doing putting together independent models said, you got to take the fudge factor out, and what it shows is that the universe is expanding. It came from a single point in time and has been expanding. And one who put together a model is actually the one who came up with the theory of the Big Bang theory, that which, by the way, is not an explanation for anything, right? It's not an explanation for anything. It's not a cause. But it does show that even science believes that the universe had a beginning. And so if those two premises are true, then therefore the universe has a cause. And that's the sticking point. For us, we believe that the cause is God. That if the universe has a beginning, the cause is God. And again, science would say, no, the Big Bang. And Charlie put up on the sign out front that the Big Bang didn't create the world. God did. The Big Bang is not an explanation. As my wife says, you can't have a Big Bang without a Big Banger, right? You can't, the Big Bang doesn't explain anything, okay? So therefore, the universe has a cause. So that's the argument we looked at last week. So the next one is the teleological argument, and I know these are complicated names. The teleological argument, though, is an argument from design. Okay? It's an argument from design. And here is the gist of it. Okay? Here's the gist of it. The appearance of design and purpose in nature implies a designer. Okay? Meaning that, there is evidence in the universe and on the earth that it has been designed. And therefore, that implies a designer. When you see something that has been designed, you do not think random chance, right? When you see something that is designed, you think, well, someone had to design it, right? Someone had to conceive of it and design it in such a way for it to function according to its purpose, okay? Now, this is not a new theory, even a recent argument. One of the most famous analogies that has been given for the teleological argument goes all the way back to the early 1800s, 1802, from an Anglican clergyman and philosopher named William Paley. And William Paley tells this analogy about a watch, okay? About a watch. And a watch, I used to be... before the advent of the Apple Watch, I used to be a watch guy. I loved watches. I still have a bunch of watches. Watches that had automatic movement. Now, the automatic movement, not from batteries, but from motion. They were built in such a way as you would walk and move your wrist, the back would spin and keep the watch wound. So these are very, very complicated machines designed to keep time. And so, but he tells this story, this analogy, and trying to explain this idea of design implying a designer. And it's this, as he says, in crossing a heath. Now the language here is a little tough because this is a long time ago, okay? This is, in crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how the stone came to be there. He says, I might possibly answer that for anything I knew, to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. So, again, it's kind of worded a little, twisted. But what he's saying is, if I'm walking across a field or across a hill and I stub my toe on a rock and someone said, well, how'd that rock get there? He's saying, for all I knew, the rock's always been there, and it would be really hard for me to say that is an absurd answer, right? Because the rock could have conceivably been there forever, right? Meaning from the beginning of the earth. It could have been there forever, right? And there's no way, it'd be very, very hard for somebody to say that that's an absurd answer, okay? He goes on to say this. He says, but Suppose I had found a watch upon the ground. So he's walking across the same place, and instead of tripping on a stone, he finds a watch. And it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think of the answer I had before given, meaning I would not think to say, well, probably the watch has always been there, like I would the rock. Okay, does that make sense? He says, I should hardly think of the answer I'd given, for anything I knew, the watch might have always been there. Saying that would actually be an absurd answer. Okay? Now, why is that an absurd answer for the watch, but not for the rock? Okay? He says, yet why should not this answer serve for the watch as well as for the stone? Okay? And the difference is design. No one looks at a watch and says that watch has always been there. No one looks at a watch and says, well, that just, again, just spontaneously appeared. It happened through natural, you know, the natural erosion of the soil and the grass, and it formed. No one would ever think that. And so he goes on, and I'm skipping a little bit in the quote, because he goes into this, in this analogy, he goes into talking about, you know, that you look at the watch, and when you see the finished product, you know that there was someone who took the materials and had to shape the materials into what was needed for the components that would be, you know, all of that. And then he concludes, he says, the watch must have had a maker, that there must have existed at some time and at some place or other an artificer. This is, again, the language. Again, we don't use those, some of those words. An artificer or artificers who formed it for the purpose which we find it actually to answer, who comprehended its construction and designed its use. Saying, you look at a watch and you go, there had to have been someone who designed and built this intricate little machine. It's different than the rock. And what's the difference? The difference is design, okay? The difference is design. Now, by the way, this is just an aside. You guys have heard me talk about Richard Dawkins over and over and over again in these lessons. Richard Dawkins, who is one of the more famous atheists out there. He's written books that have sold millions, if not hundreds of millions of copies. One of his most famous books is called The Blind Watchmaker, and that is an allusion to this analogy from William Paley about the watchmaker. And so Dawkins trying to argue that no, that does not prove that there is a designer. So that's why the title is what it is. It is a call to William Paley's story. Okay, again, that's as far as I'm going to go with that. But since I had talked about Richard Dawkins so much, I wanted to make that connection. But the question, or the idea from this is that, again, the teleological argument says that design requires a designer. Okay, if you see evidence of design, that means there had to have been a designer. So that leads us to, well, let me give you an example of that. So I have never been to Mount Rushmore. I'm sure some of you have been to Mount Rushmore. I never have. But I can't imagine that anyone ever went to Mount Rushmore and said, well, that happened due to the natural erosion of the rocks, right? Right? No one has ever looked at it and legitimately thought that, right? You look at Mount Rushmore and what do you think? Someone designed those sculptures and then hired those who would go in and carve the sculptures out of the rocks. So you look at the design and you say there had to have been a design. Okay? You with me so far? All right. So now it brings the question, does the earth or the universe show evidence of design? Okay? It's not, to this point, I don't think it's a challenge, really, because, you know, design, you look at a watch, again, you look at Mount Rushmore, and you go, it had to have been designed. But the question, the real meat of this is, well, does the earth show evidence of design? Now, we talk about another individual. His name is Hugh Ross. And Hugh Ross is an astrophysicist. He's also a Christian apologist. Meaning he's a scientist who argues for Christianity. And Hugh Ross has done a lot of study into what he refers to as the constants of physics and the parameters of the universe. Okay, and the idea here, let me give you the first part of this quote from him. He says, human existence is possible Because the constants of physics and the parameters for the universe and for the planet Earth lie within certain highly restricted ranges. And what he's saying is that there are all of these constants that exist within the Earth and within the universe at large, that if they were different by even the smallest degree than what they are, again, what is a constant? It's something that stays the same, it holds steady. If they were off by, in my way of thinking, if they were off by like a millimeter, then human life could not exist. Okay? And he says there's a whole series of these constants that exist within the universe. There's over 100. And so the rest of the night we're going to go through all 100. No, I'm kidding. We're not going to go through all of them. Okay? Now, many of these are really, really, really technical. Okay? So I'm just going to give you an example of three of them that are really, really technical. Okay? But to show that, again, as an example of what he's talking about, that all of these things exist within nature. Here's example number one. All right? He says the electromagnetic coupling constant, so that's the name of this particular constant, binds electrons to protons in atoms. Hopefully most of us remember at some point in time when we were in school studying about atoms and neutrons. We may not be able to explain it, but electrons and neutrons and all that. She says it's the constant that binds electrons to protons and atoms. The characteristics of the orbits of electrons about atoms determine to what degree atoms will bond together to form molecules. If the electromagnetic coupling constant were slightly smaller, no electrons would be held in orbits about the nuclei. If it were slightly larger, an atom could not share an electron orbit with other atoms. Either way, molecules and enhanced life would be impossible. So again, he's saying this one constant out of hundreds, if it were just slightly different, life could not exist. You with me? Whether this makes sense or not, it's the idea that this is one of over 100 examples of something that if it were just slightly different, one way or the other, life could not exist. Another example, the ratio of electron to proton mass also determines the characteristics of the orbits of electrons about nuclei. A proton is 1,836 times more massive than an electron. If the electron to proton mass ratio were slightly larger or slightly smaller, again, molecules would not form and life would be impossible. Again, another single constant, slightly larger, slightly smaller, life could not exist. Okay? Third example, and then we'll stop doing this really technical stuff. The velocity of light can be expressed in a variety of ways as a function of any one of the fundamental forces of physics or as a function of one of the fine structure constants. Hence, in the case of this constant too, the slightest change up or down would negate any possibility for life in the universe. So that's three. He found 122 of these. 122 of these constants. That if any single one of them were slightly different, life could not exist. And he went on to do some really advanced calculation with these 122 constants. Because he said, all right, what are the chances that these 122 constants could exist on any planet in our universe by chance? Meaning without a designer. Because again, the question is, does the Earth show evidence of design, right? Does the Earth show evidence of design, like a watch, like Mount Rushmore? And he said, what are the chances that any planet in our universe could have these 122 constants exist purely by random chance? Okay? And this is what he came up with. And he made an assumption. He assumed that there are 10 to the 22nd power planets in the universe. Okay? You go, Tim, I don't know what that is. Well, let me spell it out. This is 10 to the 22 planets, okay? I wrote it down somewhere. This is 10 sextillion planets, okay? That's the assumption, okay? A lot of planets, okay? That's the assumption. He said if there are 10 sextillion planets, a 10 with 22, or a 1 with 22 zeros, if there's a 1 with 22 zeros, planets, he said he found there was only one chance in 10 to the 138th power. Okay? So again, what is that? That's this number. Chance of those 122 constants naturally happening by chance on any planet. However, he pointed out that there's only about 10 to the 70 atoms in the entire universe. And so what he came to the conclusion was, it's zero chance. It's zero chance that these 122 constants could actually happen by chance. So what he's saying is, these cannot happen in nature without what? Without design. Can't happen without design. And if any one of those doesn't exist, or is slightly different, then life does not exist. The universe and the earth is a finely tuned and crafted machine. You know, and life cannot exist without a designer. He says there are only about 10 to 70 atoms in the entire universe. In effect, there is zero chance that any planet in the universe would have the life-supporting conditions we have unless there is an intelligent designer behind it all. That was his conclusion. That was his conclusion. And so, I'm going to give you guys a vote. Jeremy, do you want me to stop there 18 minutes early and give you guys a little extra time, or do you want me to keep going with the last argument? Anybody?
Keep going.
All right, let's talk about the moral argument. This one is, I believe, the most compelling. And so I think we can cover it in a few minutes, but I don't want to rush it. This one has nothing to do with science. Okay? This has nothing to do with electrons and atoms and general theory of relativity or any of that. And this to me is also the most inescapable of the arguments because I believe we exist in a moral world, not meaning that people live lives of morality, but where there are questions concerning morality all the time that we're surrounded with. But how do you have morality if we're all just a bunch of random atoms that were thrown together by the universe? And so here's the moral argument, okay? If God does not exist, then objective moral values do not exist. If you think about it, again, if we're the product of random chance, completely random, then why would there be any objective moral values? Why would there be any concept of right or wrong if we're just random chance? Does that make sense? I can't think of any reason why. I mean, there are arguments out there that, well, morals exist as these abstracts, kind of like numbers exist as abstracts. But numbers only exist when there's something to number, to count, right? How can a moral concept exist as an abstract? Again, the arguments against this are so difficult to even think about. But the moral argument says if God does not exist, then objective moral values do not exist. Okay? Which I agree with. If there's no God, if there's no creator, if there's no designer, there's no reason to have moral values. There's no reason to have a difference between right and wrong. The second part of this, the second premise is, well, objective moral values do exist. Okay? Objective moral values do exist. And if that is true, then God exists. You with me? Again, simple argument. But if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. Objective moral values do exist. If that's true, then God exists. Okay? Again, this is not science. This is morals. Okay? This is morals. I talked about in this series how I have relied heavily on an unpublished manuscript that Olivia wrote her actual manuscript was called Prepare to Give an Answer. And my favorite chapter, it's a 13-chapter book. My favorite chapter is this, the chapter she wrote that she, I've got a clip here of it, but she called The Moral Argument for the Existence of God. And the reason why this is my favorite chapter is because in her book is because of a story she tells to explain the difference between subjective morality and objective morality. Okay? And she starts it off, well, let me jump into that and say, I'm going to be pulling heavily from her story that she tells, okay? So when you see in there, I have a bunch of quotes with her name at the bottom of it, it's because I pulled it just straight off the manuscript, okay? And I want her to have the credit for that. But in this part, you know, if God does not exist and objective moral values do not exist, then she says this in the book. It says, if all we are is a cosmic accident, then there are no objective moral laws. That's the first premise, okay? If we're just an accident, a random product of complete random chance, then there can't possibly be objective moral laws, okay? Where would they come from? If there's no moral lawgiver, there can be no moral law. All morality would be subjective, okay? Which is in the eye of the beholder. And while, we'll get to this, while many people in the world will say that they believe that morality is relative, morality is subjective, it's probably less subjective. They say it's more subjective than what they actually believe. Okay, and here's the illustration that she gives. And the illustration has to do with mushroom pizza. Okay? I think last week I asked Jill if she liked mushroom pizza. You like mushroom pizza? You like mushrooms? Okay. Who in here likes mushrooms? Okay. Who detests mushrooms? Anybody? Yeah, I got a few. Yeah. It's a very polarizing food, right? Mushrooms. Okay. But it has to do with mushrooms. And this is what she says. Let's think for a moment about the difference between objective and subjective. I hate mushrooms. I hate the way they taste, the way they smell, and the way they squish in my mouth if one gets mixed in on my pizza. I say mushrooms are disgusting. Okay, you with me so far? It says, you might like mushrooms. You might think they taste good, smell wonderful, and make pizza worth eating. You say, mushrooms are delicious. Neither of us is wrong. Right? Neither of us is wrong. The statement, mushrooms are disgusting, is true when I say it because mushrooms are disgusting to me. The statement, mushrooms are delicious, is true when you say it because mushrooms are delicious to you. So the truth of the statement is dependent on the person making the statement. Therefore, it is a subjective truth. Okay? Now again, if there's no moral lawgiver, all we have is subjective truth. That's all we have. That's all we have is subjective truth. Okay? She says, an objective truth, on the other hand, is a statement that is true no matter who says it. This is not opinion. It's true no matter who says it. The statement, mushrooms are fungi, is an objective truth, and it's true whether you like them or not. Another example is Nashville is the capital of Tennessee. If someone claims that Memphis is the capital, they are objectively wrong. You see the difference in the two? In subjective and objective, okay? Subjective and objective, okay? She goes on, however, if evolution is true and humans are an accident of the universe, then they can have no inherent value. Therefore, we're going to get deep here, killing or harming another human being could not be objectively wrong. And so that's where we get, again, the difference between subjective and objective. And the first premise is if there's no God, there's no concept of anything being objectively wrong. There's no concept of anything being objectively wrong. This is, it's dense, so I don't know if you can read that or not. I'm going to read it to you. But this is, this was an article written by John Steinruckin, who is an atheist. Okay? He's an atheist. But he entitled this article, Secularisms, i.e. Atheism, Ongoing Debt to Christianity. It's an article he wrote in American Thinker. And he said, although I am a secularist, atheist if you will, I accept that the great majority of people would be morally and spiritually lost without religion. Can anyone seriously argue that crime and debauchery are not held in check by religion? Is it not comforting to live in a community where the rule of law and fairness are respected? Would such be likely if Christianity were not there to provide a moral compass to the great majority? Do we secularists not benefit out of all proportion from a morally responsible society? An orderly society is dependent on a generally accepted morality. There can be no such morality without religion. Now, this is a skeptic, an atheist, saying this. Has there ever been a more perfect and concise moral code than the one Moses brought down from the mountains? He goes on. Those who doubt the effect of religion on morality should seriously ask the question, just what are the immutable moral laws of secularism? Be prepared to answer if you're honest that such laws simply do not exist. The best answer we can ever hear from secularists to the question is a hodgepodge of strained relativist talk of situational ethics. They can cite no overriding authority other than that of fashion. For the great majority in the West, it is the Judeo-Christian tradition which offers a template assuring a life of inner peace toward the world at large, a peace which translates to a workable, liberal society. So there's an atheist saying without religion, without Judeo-Christian ethics, there would be no basis upon which to build objective morality. All you would have is subjective. And guess what? Darwin said the same thing. Not in his book On the Origin of Species, but in his book The Descent of Man, he said, if men were reared under precisely the same condition as hive bees, which again, if there's no creator, what is the difference between us and a bee? Or us and a dog? Or us and a bird? What's the difference if it's all just random chance? He says, if we are reared under precisely the same conditions as hive bees, there can hardly be a doubt that our unmarried females would, like the worker bees, think it their sacred duty to kill their brothers and mothers. Mothers would strive to kill their fertile daughters, and no one would think of interfering. No one would think of interfering. So now we'll get to the second point. So, first premise, if God does not exist, then objective moral laws do not exist. Second premise is objective moral laws or values do exist. Okay, so is that true? Is that true that there are objective moral values built, you know, within us, right? Is that something that's true? Okay, and we're going to pick back up on the mushroom pizza here, okay? Because Olivia said this, all you have to do is ask the moral relativist what they think about child abuse, rape, or murder. Ask someone what they think of Hitler's orders to torture and exterminate millions of Jews simply for the crime of being a different race. Ask them whether it was wrong for a coach to, I'll skip that word, to abuse a young child. Ask how they feel about racism. Even those who would claim to think that everything is relative would look at certain things and go, those things are wrong. Right? Those things are wrong. She says, these atrocities are not simply a matter of taste like my dislike of mushrooms. Hitler's ethnic cleansing was wrong, is my favorite statement in the whole book. Not mushroom wrong, objectively wrong. It's not subjective that what Hitler did was right or wrong. It was wrong. It was wrong. It's not a subjective truth that's only true in the mouth of the beholder and the way they view the world. No, it's wrong. But how could it possibly be wrong if there's no creator? If there's no designer? Even if Hitler had succeeded in winning the war and killing or brainwashing everyone in the world who disagreed with him, so that all people thought what he did was wonderful, he would still be wrong. It shouldn't take very long for the moral relativist to realize that upon further inspection, some things are in fact objectively wrong. Objectively wrong. C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, if you're not super familiar with him, maybe you've heard the name. He was a writer. He was a professor. and one who grew up in a Christian environment, who became an atheist, and who returned to Christianity later in his life. Many of his, even his fictional books carry religious themes in them. If you've read any of the Narnia books, they, even though they are fantasy books, they are, there are certain characters in those fantasy stories which are meant to represent, figures in Scripture. But he said this: "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got the idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple." He says, how can you even say something is just or unjust unless there is a standard? Unless there is a standard. And so the conclusion is, if objective morality does exist, then there has to be a reason for it to exist. And Christians would say, well, the reason why objective morality exists is because there is an intelligent lawgiver that wrote that morality in our hearts. Otherwise, why would we be different than any other creature in the universe? Why would any action that we took or anyone else took be right or wrong? The only explanation that I can come up with to explain why we have any sense of right and wrong is that that sense was instilled in us by the one who created us, the one who designed us, the one who spoke us into existence. Otherwise, I don't know where you go. I don't know where you go. And any doubts that I may have in my life about, does God really exist? When it comes down to it, I go, but I can't explain this any other way. No matter what doubts I may have in my life, and I've had doubts. I know I've had talked to people who said I've never had a doubt one day in my life. I'm not one of those people. I've had doubts. Especially in times of trial. In times of trial, it's easier for me to have doubts. But I come back to things like this and go, but if you take away God, I can't explain this. And I don't know how you do. Again, as the secularist who wrote an American Thinker said, when you ask an atheist how you can explain morally objective values, their explanation is just, it's talking about how morals exist in this abstract thing where they can exist separate from humans. And it's like, you have no idea. You have no idea. And I can't explain it. So again, this doesn't prove God in the sense of like proof in a courtroom, like beyond the standard that the prosecution is held to, beyond a reasonable doubt, right? You can't provide objective, visual proof or you can't see God. But I don't know how you explain this without God. I don't know how you do it. And as I said before, these are the kinds of conversations we need to be having with our children, with our grandchildren, who are being influenced by the world, who the world has an answer to everything. Most of them are the wrong answers. They have an answer to everything. These are the conversations we need to be having with our young people, having with our friends and neighbors, having with those who don't believe in the Bible. Where do you start with somebody that doesn't believe in the Bible? You start with this. This doesn't take the Bible to have this conversation. Because I can't explain this. To me, this is the most powerful. The scientific ones, they make sense to me. But this one, I don't have to know a lick of science. I don't have to study a lick of science for this to make sense to me. And I don't know how you explain it without a God. But I believe there is a God who has always existed. Johnny and I were talking about last week about Johnny, and said, I hope you don't mind me sharing this. He said, if God had taken the time to try to write out an explanation for how he's always existed, we wouldn't understand it anyway. And I love that. I'm like, that's right. That's right. If I try to think about God having always existed, it just makes my brain just, my brain just starts, I feel like swelling in my head. It's like it hurts. And if he'd taken the time to write out exactly how that works, we wouldn't understand it anyway. But I don't know how you explain this universe without an eternal being. How do you have a Big Bang without someone who caused it? I don't know how you do it. But I'm thankful that not only do I believe in a God who has always existed, but I believe in a God who loves me, who loves all of us, so much so that in this just world that he created, where justice will be served, and we are unjust, not worthy, that he completed a plan to save us in spite of our sins. If you're here tonight and you've never given your life to the one who has paid for your sins, why not start tonight? Why not start tonight? If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while we sing our invitation song.